From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, a comedy show. First, we hear from Tracy Ullman, and she'll do some of the characters she's created for her HBO series, Tracy Takes On. Then from the archives, the king of the one-liners, Henny Youngman, who died earlier this year. This week, Richard Pryor received the first Mark Twain Prize, the Kennedy Center's Award for Humor. We'll feature a 1995 interview with Pryor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House says there's been a snag in the Middle East peace agreement worked out in eastern Maryland. The Israelis want the United States to release convicted American spy Jonathan Pollard, who's serving a life sentence for spying for Israel. The Israelis say the United States had agreed to release Pollard as part of the deal, but the United States says there never was such an arrangement. The proposed peace deal calls for Israel to withdraw from more of the West Bank, while the Palestinians must stamp out terrorism. NPR's Eric Weiner in Jerusalem reports the agreement will be a tough sell for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Right-wing groups, which include many Jewish settlers, say they're not prepared to hand over one more acre of land to the Palestinians. They've been against this peace process from the beginning. So to some extent, it really didn't matter what kind of agreement Prime Minister Netanyahu signed with the Palestinians in Maryland. These groups were going to be opposed to it. So I think we're about to see a lot of vocal opposition to this agreement from right-wing groups. However, the majority of Israelis, when polled, say that they are in favor of an agreement, that they want to see the peace process get back on track.
NPR's Eric Weiner reporting. The huge gas fire in Nigeria that's killed more than 700 people is finally out. Local firefighters stopped trying to douse the blaze last Monday. A Texas company arrived on the scene and put it out in about an hour. The fire began Saturday as thieves tried to tap a gas pipeline. The fire burned through several villages. Local officials believe the death toll will eventually top 1,000. A court in Tokyo has handed down the first death sentence in connection with a former Doomsday cult member charged with murdering four people. The cult is accused of releasing nerve gas in the Tokyo subway system in 1995. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from the Japanese capital.
38-year-old Kazuaki Okazaki was sentenced to death for his role in the murder of Tony Sakamoto, an attorney investigating the cult at the time of his death. Sakamoto's wife and one-year-old son were also killed by cult members who crept into his home and drugged and strangled the family. The court would not be swayed by pleas for leniency. Defense lawyers argued that Okazaki demonstrated remorse by turning himself in, but the court concluded he'd come forward to protect himself, that he acted out of his own free will, and not, as defense argued, under mind control by the cult. The Ohm attack on Tokyo subways terrorized Japan 3 years ago, and trials of cult members have been slowly wending their way through the courts. A previous defendant was sentenced to life. Okazaki is the first to be sentenced to die. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Tokyo.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 51 points at 8,481. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, high technology stocks are maintaining their momentum at the end of the trading week, but the rest of the market seems to be lagging. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
It has been a mixed session so far for Wall Street. While the Dow has been mostly lower today, the Nasdaq exchange, which is home to a number of technology companies, is modestly higher. Among the tech stocks doing well today, Gateway, the country's fourth largest computer maker, which says it earned 51 cents a share during its latest quarter. That was 4 cents above analysts' expectations. Meantime, stock and athletic apparel maker Reebok is down today. That's after the company reported a 50% drop in third quarter profits. Analysts say some of the market malaise may be due to the fact there is little in the way of economic news to motivate investors today. They also point to the fact that after 7 straight positive closes, the Dow's longest streak since 1997, things may be settling down. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A pair of internet music retailers are merging. CD Now and N2K are getting together to try to stay a step ahead of fast-growing rivals like Amazon.com. The new company will offer approximately 500,000 items, by far the largest selection of music products available to consumers. The chairman of Japanese electronic company NEC Corporation says he will step down. Chairman Tadiro Sakamoto says he plans to resign because of a defense procurement scandal. Sakamoto says he does not know anything about the scandal, which involved alleged corruption in military purchases, but is leaving to accept responsibility for the situation. Again on Wall Street, the Dow is down 51 at 84.81. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By Columbia Records, presenting the new self-titled album from John Mellencamp featuring Your Life Is Now, available in stores. And HarperCollins, publisher of Barbara Kingsolver's new novel, The Poisonwood Bible, available in bookstores nationwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today's Archive Edition is a comedy show. Let's start with one of the funniest and most versatile comic actresses working today, Tracy Ullman. Her HBO series, Tracy Takes On, is a series of comic sketches in which she appears as a different character in each sketch. The series returns in early 1999. Ullman also has been turning up on Ally McBeal as McBeal's therapist. I spoke with Tracy Ullman last winter, and we talked about some of the characters she does in her series. Let's start maybe with Linda Granger, a kind of washed-up actress and professional victim.
Well, darling, I love Linda Granger. Linda loves being on National Public Radio. Linda's the kind of person that goes on public television fund drives. And she says things like, you know, public television is a wonderful thing for all of us. You know, and it's the time, don't you love those pledge drives when people like Linda Granger get to go on public television? And normally she's doing complete dross infomercials, but then she gets to go and do a pledge drive. I see Linda's around L.A. all the time, you know.
Just describe her
pretending
for
to be 39 and they're 55, and she's had a little collagen in her lips, and my cosmetic surgeon is an artist. And as long as they're doing infomercials or they're appearing on Gay Talk on public access with her solid homosexual fan base, she's in show business, Terry.
Does she seem like a cautionary tale to you of what an actress is capable of becoming if she's not careful?
She's a certain type of actress. I mean, she would do theater. Oh, theater is my first love, Terry. And
right.
She's always doing love letters with Hank Brinkley from the Channel 5 News. You notice the love letters pairings, Terry, got really terrible.
Oh,
today.
I know.
It was like they had to just put a stop to them.
For our listeners who don't know love letters, it's a two-person show that started off, you know, with, I think, Eli Wallach and his wife. And then as it went around the country, the stars got less and less stellar.
Yeah, Joe Namath and Phyllis Diller in love letters. I know, the combos got kind of, but it was that sort of, you didn't have to learn the lines. You could just sit and read it, you know, and I imagine Linda, you know, doing that show somewhere in the wilds with a pair of reading glasses from a pharmacy, you know, dinner theater.
Now, another character you're doing now is Sidney Cross, who is a lawyer. Describe what kind of lawyer she is.
When I started doing this show 3 years ago, I wanted to play like an aggressive, ambitious career woman and living in Los Angeles. And I thought, well, an agent was a little passé. And Sidney Cross, at that time, it was the O.J. Simpson trial, and we had all these lawyers going on TV every night. And I thought, do a lawyer. And the physicalities of Leslie Abramson were fascinating to me. So physically, it's a little like Leslie Abramson. I added my own sharky, gappy baby teeth, which really give me the character. And it's the voice of an agent of mine who was, like, crazed. Hi, Tracy, how you doing? You want to win an Oscar? We're going to win a pink Oscar. She used to call me up every day. I think, oh, God, this woman's going to drive me crazy. And she's a relentlessly charmless litigator, and relentlessly ambitious and charmless litigator. That's how she's described. And but now she's kind of become endearing to me, Terry. This is the funny things about my characters. They are so, as gross as Sidney Cross is, I realise she's lonely. She can't get laid. You know, she's so ugly.
Not even by your cabbie
she's
character.
She's so ambitious. No, exactly. Even Chick can't do it. And she's the sort of person that lives in a very sterile sort of apartment with some unassembled Nautilus equipment in the corner that never got, you know, and pot noodles, and she's never home. And I just, you know, now I feel sorry for her. And as soon as I feel sorry for them, I can work on them even more.
Another character that you do is Cheek the cabbie. Right. And I'm wondering how often you actually have taken cabs in New York.
Oh, well, a lot.
Yeah.
And was always bumping into people like Chick, who seemed to have just no sense of humour. And if you say, where are you from? You know, trying to talk, what are you, secret police? You know, one of those guys, they're immediately uptight and no humour and very aggressive, driving aggressively, and hey, come on, what's the matter with you? Come on, Salami. And he would always go. I remember I was in a cab one day with some guy like this, and he's going, the man this morning, I get my cab from him, and he called me a piece of shit, and I'm going to kill him. Tonight I go, I blow his brains out. I was like, oh, I wonder if I should go to my appointment or just call the police. You know, I'm thinking he was so aggressive and driving so aggressively. I always say to these guys, can you slow down? You know, I've got two children, I don't want to die. And the smell of English leather aftershave that wafts through the vents of the cab. And
what happens when they find out you're in show business?
You know, I've got a movie. You know, they always say this type of chick, chicken. You know, Martin Scorsese, I was using my cab. I said to him, I want to do a movie about Vegas, you know, gambling, and the Max Casino. What do I get from it, eh? Huh? It's always like it was their idea. I had Andrew Lloyd Webber in the cab, and I said, do a Phantom of the Opera, maybe you should do it. What does he give to Chick, eh?
Yeah, there's guys, it was always their idea. He is of indeterminate Middle Eastern origin, and I'm wondering if you ever get any flack for, you know, when you do somebody who is of a different ethnic group than you are. I have been told by several satirist that it's a very difficult time to do satire because everybody is so kind of defensive about somebody representing or stereotyping their ethnic
political
group.
Political correctness is just so, it's just inhibiting, it's just strangling this country, you know. I mean, if you do it with the right energy and spirit, we are different. Some people do talk like this, some people do wear clothes like this, some people do eat foods like this. I mean, you know, you have to be, I know, you have to be so cautious, and I'm not a racist. I'm not doing caricatures. I'm just impersonating people I see. And I do research my characters very thoroughly. And I know that I got a bit of flack initially for the Asian character that I do. Indeterminate Asian. There you go. See, you don't say where she's from either. Mrs. Nonanine. And
She's the owner of a donut shop.
Yeah. I sell donut. I see this. I know this woman. I get donuts when we're doing our writers' meetings. And I think it's difficult. It was a bit shocking for the Asians because they don't really have a lot of representation in the comedy world on television. And so there was a bit of an outcry about that. And HBO defended me and said, look, she does it in the right spirit, it's with the right energy, and she has a right to do it. And then I began to get letters from teenage Asian kids, and they'd say, this is great, and you're like my grandma, and you know, if we don't have anyone on TV that actually is Asian, at least we've got you. And we just, now she's very, you know, because my criteria for doing a character, Terry, is do they exist?
Mm-hmm.
Do people talk like this? Do they look like this? And, you know, I can impersonate them. I want to.
Did you ever run into this kind of criticism in England?
No. I have a new character in the show, the Black Lady, and that's great fun. And it was about time I did a black character. It was just difficult to do the makeup. You know, it's always, that is time consuming. And, but that went out in my first show, and I've had a lot of response.
This is the character who works at the airport.
It's great fun. Yeah, Shanisha.
Yeah, she works at the airport at the, not the X-ray,
right.
What you call it, with the security thing.
Because every time I go through those things, the woman always says to me, they look at me, they go, you're on TV? There's always that moment they look at me, shit on TV! And I just thought, I love those, the airports. It's totally run by these incredible black women with fabulous hairstyles. And they have a moment of supreme power when you go through that security check. I stopped at Steven Spielberg. I said, hey, you stand still. You want to get on that plane? You want to get on that plane? That plane could blow up. I'm security. Everybody, they don't have time for security. You know, and they just get mad because you don't want to stop. You don't want me to search your bag. Put your keys in a bowl and walk for a game.
I see all your characters, and they're all so convincing. And I think, gee, do you go through an identity crisis? Do you look in the mirror and think, I could be anybody, depending on what accent I put on or what, how I do my hair? I mean, you could pass for anybody.
It's weird. I guess if I was a Buddhist, which is the religion I'm most interested in, is I suppose I'm reincarnated many, many times, and I have been all these people. That might be an explanation for it. The Buddhists seem to know exactly why I'm like this.
Let me stop you, because I don't think that's true, because Fern Rosenthal didn't live centuries ago.
Yeah, I know, she is so... I did, Terry, but I couldn't get my hair done. There was no good dye. There was this awful inky stuff they'd put on it down by the river. There was henna. Ugh, it was awful. Thank God for L'Oreal. Yeah, I know. She's so... An acrylic. We couldn't get the acrylic nails. We did it with porcelain hundreds of years ago, Terry. It was awful. It would break. It would shatter.
She's one of my favorite characters of yours. She's the housewife from
Gross.
Long Island.
Are you a Jew? Are you, Terry, are you Jewish?
I think I'm good for the Jews.
Yeah, are you a Jew? I'm asking you a question, darling. Are you a Jew?
Yeah, Fern, yeah.
You a Jew? You have any family like Fern?
Not exactly, but I've had neighbors.
Come on, no. Yeah, I've had neighbors. Jews never admit there's someone like Fern in their family. You go to Florida, Terry? You have any family in Florida?
I have family in Florida, yes. I know many Ferns
where,
in Florida.
Darling, tell me. Talk to me. You like to go to the theater in Florida? They like to go to the big theaters?
It's all dinner theater.
They're dragging him around to see Dreamgirls and stuff, you know. He wants to see a show with a lot of Schwartzes.
Did you ever meet anyone who's the equivalent of Fern Rosenthal in Florida? I mean, in...
What? Just what? State in the obvious.
I mean, in England.
No, it was really hard.
I meant to say in England.
In England, it's the Jews live in Golders Green and Dallas Hill. Now, I'm doing an American accent here, but they're very, oh, darling, listen. They're very Jewish. It's the same thing. They got to American Jews, English Jews, they got off the boat too early. They missed out. When my friend Gail Parent meets English Jews, oh, you got off the boat too early. So,
are there a lot of types you've been exposed to in America that you didn't have in England?
New York Jews, seriously, to me, are incredibly funny. I love them. And they love the foreign character. And they're very accepting of me. And, I mean, you know, I feel like I'm an honorary Jew.
Tracy Ullman, it's just been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's lovely to talk to you.
Tracy Ullman recorded last winter. Her HBO comedy series, Tracy Takes On, returns in early 1999. This is Fresh Air. Like most of the guests we've had on this week, Tracy Ullman listens to public radio, but I understand that actress Linda Granger has decided not to make a pledge this year so she can save up for the facelift she needs for her next infomercial, which she is hoping will be the career breakthrough she's been waiting for. But what about you? Have you pledged? Please call now. Thank you. Thank you. John Lovitz is the new star of the NBC sitcom News Radio. He plays the new on-air personality, Max Lewis. Lovitz replaced the late Phil Hartman. Hartman and Lovitz had first become stars on Saturday Night Live. Lovitz joined the cast in 1984. He appeared in a number of films after leaving the show in 1990, and he was the voice of the critic in the animated TV series The Critic. I spoke with John Lovitz in 1992 about his days on Saturday Night Live.
I'd like to ask you about some of the characters that you created for Saturday Night Live.
Oh, okay.
Why don't we start with Tommy Flanagan, the pathological liar, which is the character that you first really became famous for from the show. How did you create him?
Well, I got it from old movies when, you know, in the 40s, and I'd say, yeah, that's the ticket. And yeah, I mean, I didn't make up that phrase. And then it really started as an inside joke between a friend of mine and I and a girl, and she... I was always trying to pick up on her, and she said she liked the guy with the fat wallet. So I'd say, well, you know, my dad just had 15 oil wells come in. And she'd say, yeah, right. And I'd say, well, I am a pathological liar. And the first time I did it, you know, I did it, and people laughed. And then this engineer that worked at NBC came up to Lauren's office and said, oh, that's the funniest thing I ever saw. You should put that on more. And so it's because of the audience response, really, that you repeat characters. You know, it's not the other way around. It's the audience picks the... hit characters, and then, you know, so you continue to do them.
But at a certain point, you gave up the character. What was that point?
Well, I'd done it so many times, and I just wanted to move on.
Mm-hmm.
So after the second year, it was just kind of enough.
So you decided to stop it.
Yeah, people are, you know, on Saturday Night Live, they're kind of weird about that. When you have a hit character, they...
They want you to milk it?
Well, no, they want you to do it, and then when it becomes popular, then everyone tends to... You know, because they're comedians, they tend to make fun of it and not really, you know, go, yeah, that. And it's an odd, it's a weird thing when you have a hit character. They're not saying, hey, that's great. They're kind of saying, like, making fun of it. Because the show, I guess, is supposed to be, like, anti-culture, you know, or whatever, you know, against the establishment. So when you have a hit character and it becomes part of that, then they end up, you know, making fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
So then after, you know, it bothered me at first, and then after a while I go, okay, I get it, you know. But I kind of got tired of doing it, and then it made me feel good when I did Annoying Man my last year, and I just slapped it together and, like, you know, I just said, give me the costume, and I wrote it in like 30 seconds.
You want to describe the character?
I just trying to be somebody who's annoying in every possible way, and a very grating voice, and, you know, like, hello, how are you? You know, and if you listen to someone talk like that for a long time, it would start getting annoying. And then I would chew on tin foil and take a fork and, you know, scrape it against a pan. And, you know, really grating a chalkboard, you know, it was really grating. And it was just very silly. And in my opinion, it was very stupid. It was just being very silly. And it was taking a character like that, and then, which was completely non-cerebral, just, you know, ridiculously silly and dumb. And then, it became popular, and it felt it felt good to me because a lot of the writers are from Harvard, and they're like, oh, you know, they're trying to write really sophisticated, clever stuff that doesn't work a lot of times. And then you just come along with something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, you know,
ha-ha. So let me ask you about Master Thespian, your most pretentious actor. What was the story behind the creation of that character?
Oh, well, I went to a college at UC Irvine, and there was a professor of mine, William Needles, who taught me Shakespeare. And when he would do it, though, himself, he'd always go, he'd say, like, the opening speech from Henry V, the chorus, and was, oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. And he would say, like, oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. Like that. And I thought it was very funny. I thought it was very good, but very funny, too. And I used to imitate him, and then I kind of put it together with, you know, and then I wanted to be an actor, and an actor is a, you know, that's what a thespian is. So I was like the master thespian. You know, I was just joking around with my friend and say, I'm the master thespian, because I just wanted to be a great actor. That was my goal.
Were there any jokers in your family? Did you have a father who would sit around the dinner table and tell jokes?
Yeah, he used to goof off, and he used to make prank phone calls, and... I mean, the look for Annoying Man I got from him, he used to comb his hair forward and wear his glasses low. He didn't act like that, but that's where I got the look from. And he used to do something. He used to come home and tell us he was his twin brother, Howard, we would be like 7 or 8 in a, but he would play it so straight for like a half an hour and just insist on it, and then he would leave, and then like 20 minutes later come back. I guess he would just wait in his car. And then we'd say, Howard was here. He goes, he was? You know.
So he really had a twin brother, Howard?
Huh? No, he didn't.
Oh, he didn't?
No, he just said he did.
I see. Okay.
We were young. He would do stuff like that.
One of my favorite sketches of the ones that you've done on Saturday Night Live was Harry Hanukkah.
Oh.
Did you write that?
No, Al Franken and Mike Myers wrote it.
Oh.
And, but I based it on, they wrote it and it was really funny. And then I based it on this actor, Ned Glass. Ned Glass talks like this. And he was the father on Bridget and Bernie. He was the Jewish father. He was in, he's probably the best West Side Story. He was Pops, who I guess who runs the drugstore, the candy store.
Mm-hmm.
And, when I was 15 years old...
What's wrong with you kids?
Well, when I was... You know, if you see these movies, you know who he is. When I was 15 years old, I was at my best friend's house, and his father is a doctor, and Ned Glass was one of his patients. And I was 15, and my friend's father says to Ned Glass, John wants to be an actor. And he says, you want to be an actor? He goes, what would you do if you hurt your toe? And I said, I'd say, ouch. He goes, would you say ouch if you were Hercules? And he goes, you know what you have to do? Because you know what you have to know to be an actor? You have to know everything. You think you could know everything? You have to know everything. You know, so as if he knew everything. And then he goes, you know, there was only... he was the same in everything he played. And he was, you know, he was a good actor and he was funny, but he was always... He was just himself. He was exactly the same. And he says, you know... There was only two actors who were never typecast, me and Paul Muni. And so, anyways, I never forgot him, he was good. He was a funny actor, you know, he's funny, but, you know, he never, I guess he always thought he played all these different characters, and really he was just always, hello, how are you? I mean, in Julius Caesar, in the movie with Marlon Brando, he's in the opening market scene, and everyone's going, my lord, come here and hither, and he's in the market saying, you want to buy some oranges, my lord? You know.
John Lovitz, recorded in 1992. He's the new star of the NBC sitcom News Radio. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on this Comedy Archive edition, the king of the one-liners, the late Henny Youngman. And we hear from Richard Pryor. This week he received the first Mark Twain Prize for humor from the Kennedy Center.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Columbia Records, presenting the new self-titled album from John Mellencamp, featuring Your Life Is Now, available in stores. And Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
The king of the one-liners, Kenny Youngman. What a crowd. If I had blood, I'd blush. Downtown, I said to a lady, you know where Michigan Avenue is? She says, yeah. And she walked away. One fellow said, give me $10 till payday. I said, when is payday? He said, you ought to know. You're the one that's working. One fellow said, I haven't eaten in 2 days. I said, you should force yourself. One fellow said, I haven't tasted food all week. I said, don't worry, it tastes the same.
Today's Archive Edition is a comedy show which gives us the chance to replay our interview with Henny Youngman. He did it all, vaudeville, speakeasies, the Borscht Belt, Ed Sullivan, nightclubs, casinos, and sometimes even bar mitzvahs. He never tried to keep up with the times, and there were plenty of periods when younger people thought him hopelessly square. But he'd been Henny Youngman for so long he'd become hip. Henny Youngman was 91 when he died earlier this year. I spoke with him when he was 85. I started with the question that you have to ask Henny Youngman. How did he come up with his most famous one-liner, take my wife, please?
I was on the Kate Smith show at the time, and my wife came in a half hour before the show. Henny, I need 8 tickets for the show. Luckily, the ushers saved some tickets for me every week. I used to give them $2. That's all I had left. So I got the tickets for Sadie, and I said, take my wife, please. Like, get her out of here. I want her in the audience. And that stuck all these years.
Do you still have jokes in your repertoire that go back to your days in vaudeville?
Sure, I do the same jokes now. I need a new audience. That's all I need. Yeah, I'm always adding.
What are some of the ones that go back to
I take my wife everywhere, but she finds a way home. I said, where do you want to go for your anniversary? She said, I want to go somewhere I've never been before. I said, try the kitchen.
Now, how did you start doing, jokes that basically, insult women?
Well, I'll tell you, they're cute. They're not insults. They're cute, but we have to bounce off somebody, You have to make fun of my brother-in-law. You know how he gets rid of his garbage? He gift-wrapped it, leaves it in the car, they steal it. How long are you going to wait to laugh, Terry?
Oh, I had to think that one through
explain,
first.
Yeah, I know it. I got to explain the jokes to you.
What's your most stolen joke?
Take my wife, please. You hear that all over the country.
But everybody knows that's yours.
Yeah.
So
I think I'm associated with it by now.
But what about a joke that's been stolen that people don't realize is
Well,
yours?
I do all the wife jokes and the brother-in-law jokes. They take them every day. A hooker walked up to me. She said, I'll do anything you want for $50. I said, paint my house. That's around the country now. I brought that around,
You write in your book about how you still work the phones all the time. And it sounds like, if you're at the Carnegie Deli, the phone rings for you. In the barber's chair, you're calling.
Wherever it is,
days.
I let people know where I'm at.
Yeah, no.
In case you need me for a job, you know where to get me. My service knows where I am at. I let word when I came at the studio here that I'm here to get my phone calls.
Have you gotten any calls yet?
I don't know. I'm talking to you.
Let's ask Leszek, the engineer. Leszek, has he gotten any phones yet?
Just one.
He's got one phone call already?
Yes.
Who is it from?
It was a gentleman who didn't introduce himself.
Oh, okay. Well, who knows what that's going to be,
yeah,
right?
I get calls all day.
Now, I've heard that you have a listed number in the New York directory.
Sure, I don't owe any money.
Yeah, so just to test it out, I called
New York information earlier today, and I said to the operator, "Operator, I'd like the number for Henny Youngman in Manhattan." And the operator said, "The Henny Youngman?" And I said, "Yes." And the operator said, "He would not have a listed number." I said, "No, no, but I think he does." And sure enough.
That's astounding, you know, because people think you haven't got a number. That's no good. I want them to know I have a number so they can get to me.
But don't the people who really need to get to you for business reasons know how to reach you?
Sure, now they do. You're letting them know.
Now, if I call that up, would I just get an answering machine, or would you
pick
it up?
No, you get my service.
Oh, I see. Oh, no wonder you could give it out so liberally.
I don't care. As long as I don't owe any money.
Are you doing any topical jokes in
Very
your show
seldom.
Now?
No, not too many.
You have a great Imelda Marcos one in the book.
Yeah, well, I did it, but she's in Israel planting a shoe tree.
Yeah, I really love that.
Yeah, well, that was topical. It's still good sometimes. But I try to get jokes on a topic at once. Now, I'm just saying, now, Liz Taylor's been married 8 times. She has rice marks on her face. I did that about Zsa Gabor. But now that she's doing it, I use it on her.
Now, do you do all your own jokes now, or do you have writers who are doing them?
No, I haven't. I haven't got a steady job. I don't need writers. I got 2 hours of material in my head. I go out on the stage, I do 40 minutes, 45 minutes.
You're still telling Take My Wife jokes?
All the time.
How do they go over now?
Fine.
Yeah, still in the age of the women's
movement?
Sure,
my wife and I are always holding hands. If I leave, go, she shops.
How did your wife when...
My wife was a pretty woman. She didn't mind what I said about her. She ran after the garbage man. Am I too late for the garbage? She said, no, jump in. My wife didn't know I worked at these gangster places. She would have been frightened. She didn't mind it at all. She didn't know what I was doing. I had conflicts with my wife all the time because my wife was a day person. She wanted me to have a job 9 to 5. I got lucky, and I got in another business which she knew nothing about, and my family resented it. Her family resented it. They thought I was a bum because I hung out in Lindy's till 4 in the morning. They never heard of Lindy's. So I had that to contend with all my life until my wife finally accepted me coming home late at night.
So the marriage withstood both your jokes and your wife's lack of understanding of show business.
Yeah, sure. Well, I wouldn't leave my family. I wouldn't leave them. And she wouldn't leave me. Where would she go? She had 2 kids, you know. So we had a lot of fights and arguments over these things. Making people understand what you're doing is very tough, especially when in my business.
Now, what about your parents? Did they ever understand?
No. Well, how would they understand? I was playing people. If I didn't take them to New York, I don't think they would have gone. They lived in Brooklyn.
No, you got thrown out of high school, right?
I was asked to leave, yeah.
What for?
Telling jokes or breaking up the class. Teacher thought I was a nuisance. He could have laughed, but he was an idiot, I guess.
So when you were thrown out of high school, what did you do next?
My father made me learn a trade, printing. I went to Brooklyn Vocational Trade School.
So how did you go from, you know,
I don't know,
trade school and all this to
I had
to
a band.
I was,
my father made me study fiddle. Mm-hmm. My mother.
Well, they wanted
my aunt gave me a fiddle. Her son didn't want it.
They wanted you to be a great classical violinist.
Right, sure. I studied 7 years. And we had a comedy band like Spike Jones. And one night, an act didn't show up, so the boy said, "Henny, you know a lot of jokes. You got to save my life. I got a banquet out there." I went on. I told all my jokes. I did a half hour. I was a riot, really. I had a lot of funny stuff. He said, "Let the band go, will you? I'll keep you." So I became a comedian.
And when you were getting started and you were trying to, you know, convince people to hire you, where would you go?
Well, I went around all the agents in New York. There were booking agents.
Uh-huh.
There were buildings that had booking agent on the door. So I'd walk in and introduce myself. Some of them used me, found out it was funny, and that was it. I got around. I got jobs here and there. Got jobs with the fiddle. I got jobs telling jokes.
Would you have to do shtick for the booking agents in their office?
Well, I used to come in. I usually come in with a joke of the day. I used to find a joke and tell it to them. They laughed at me, and they got to like me, you know. You got to prove you're a comedian. You can say it, but you got to prove it.
You know, a lot of interviewers like to ask the tombstone question, what would you like written on your tombstone? I myself never asked this question, but to you, I'm just curious if you want a one-liner on yours.
Well, I really never figured that out, honestly. When I lost my wife, I used to say, "Take my wife, please." That's the one time I didn't want to say it.
Yeah.
I'll have to figure that out. What to say on there? Leave him laughing. Ha, ha, ha.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. When you come to New York, call me. Take my number.
Please.
Please. I'll take you to the Friars for lunch.
Oh, boy, I'd really love that.
Yeah, you might enjoy it. Hey, Terry, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, and
it's
I wish
a pleasure,
you the best.
Really.
Henny Youngman, recorded in 1991. He died last February at the age of 91. By the way, I never called him about lunch. Coming up from the archives, Richard Pryor. This is Fresh Air. Richard Pryor was given the first Kennedy Center honor for humor Tuesday night. Comics and actors gathered to pay tribute to him. Pryor has advanced multiple sclerosis and was unable to rise from his wheelchair for a bow. He could barely say thank you. He had a little more stamina in 1995 when I spoke with him. Richard Pryor started his career by imitating Bill Cosby, but he later said he knew his days of pretending to be as slick and colorless as Cosby were numbered. There was a world of junkies and winos, pool hustlers and prostitutes, friends and family screaming inside his head trying to be heard. His comedy was filled with perceptions about being African-American in America, and he took his personal tragedies like his heart attack and transformed them into comedy.
Anybody here ever had a heart attack? No, motherfucker never admit they had a heart attack, right, Bill?
No, sir, I never did. I had indigestion one time.
I don't care what nobody tell your ass, boy. I was walking in the yard and somebody said,
"Don't breathe no more." I said, "Huh?" I said, "Don't breathe no motherfucking more. You heard me." Okay, I won't breathe, I won't breathe, I won't breathe.
And I tried to ease a little air inside of my mouth. And I said, "Say, did I tell you not to breathe?" "You told me not to breathe. You told me not to breathe." "Well, where are you going? Why are you walking? Stand still." "Okay, I'll stand still. Get your ass down." "Okay, I'm down. I'm down. I'm down. Don't hurt me. Don't hurt me. Don't hurt me." "Shut the f*** up. You think about dying, ain't you?" "Yeah, yeah." "Why didn't you think about that when you was eating that pork, mother f***?"
Pryor's performing career was virtually ended by multiple sclerosis, which was first diagnosed in 1986. When I spoke with him in 1995, he was at the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. I asked him about his physical therapy.
This lady, I think her name is Marie. She's my therapist.
Mm-hmm.
She comes 3 times a week.
What's the therapy like?
Oh, man. Some days, it's like, I don't feel good, you know? And so I don't want to do it. But she says, "Well, you have to do it." So 3 times a week, that's what I'm put up with.
Was it like moving arms and legs and things like that?
Man, there was a time I couldn't move any of them. I was in bed like that for a while. I couldn't move.
What did you do to pass the time while you were in bed and couldn't move?
Good question. I'm trying to think, what did I do? Oh, I remember I smoked some bass. No, I did.
Did you really, or are you?
No, I'm serious. And my ex-wife, Flynn, came to visit me, and she walked through my stuff. And she found it, and she said, "What is this?" I had a rock, you know. She said, "What's this?" And I didn't tell her because I was scared. And she said, "Is this dope?" I said, "Nah." I said, "Just looks like it, but that's not really." And she threw it out.
So, have you stopped?
Yes.
Was there a turning point that got you to stop?
Yes. Well, it's called being broke.
Now, let me ask you an odd question. I mean, about freebasing. It's bad for your health, right? But, I mean, your health isn't good anyway. So would it being bad for your health not be likely to inspire you to stop? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You're making sense, is what you're saying. And if I was that type of person that made sense, I wouldn't be where I am. Because I never made no sense. You know, it was like, life to me was like, not supposed to make sense. Because, hey, it's, I don't care how you slice it, you ain't getting out alive. So enjoy as much as you can.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, some of the things you did were really self-destructive. The free bracing, the setting yourself on fire.
That was a definite.
Definitely self-destructive, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but you know, and it's the kind of behavior that you're warned is going, you know, to really kill you. And you survived all of that. And now you have a disease, MS, that has absolutely nothing, as far as I know, to deal with, you know, quote, bad behavior. Do you know what I'm saying? So it just seems like such an irony that all the things people warned you would really hurt you.
It was the MS.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with you getting MS.
No. It's just like God say, "Oh, really? Okay, here, boom." So try that on.
Well, do you think it's God punishing you for things you've done? Is that what you're saying?
No. Uh-huh. God don't work like that.
Yeah, so I mean, you could have lived this absolutely exemplary life and still gotten MS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a blessing, though.
Getting MS?
Yeah.
How so?
Because it pushes me forward. I'm going through the therapy, and I'm understanding some things about life I never understood.
Anything you'd care to talk about, or is that too personal to discuss?
There's nothing so personal as when you can't walk the way you want to, and then you have to depend on others to help you. And I go, "Oh, my God." And that's what it is. It's depending on people. And you have to learn to trust them, which is very hard for me. Very hard. But here I am.
You are so important to so many people. I mean, so many people have, like, looked up to you for so long. Do you feel that you have to try to handle your illness now as, like, a role model? Do you know what I mean? Like, when you're a public person like yourself and people are looking at you, do you feel like, yeah, that you need to do it like a role model? Not that you've been a traditional role model to anybody in the past.
It's like...
not that you've taught us to behave in socially accepted ways in the past.
Yeah. Hey, God gave me this. And I'm going to say this truthfully. God gave me just a little bit of it, you know? He said, "So slow down for a minute. Take a break. You know, take a break and look at things differently." So I do. Rich is not a bad person. And this disease is just a disease. And I have it. So that's what I deal with.
I know you keep a gun next to your bed.
Yeah.
What for?
Because the boogeyman might come in some night.
Who are you expecting?
The boogeyman. I mean, come on. There's such terrible things going on in the world. People are crazy. They're serious about whatever craziness it is. And I don't want to be caught in no trap and not be able to get off one shot.
I mean, excuse me for asking this, but would you be able to even use the gun if you had cause to?
No. I think the hard thing I do is having to cock it. Because it's a 9mm. And the bolt is real hard for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll say, wait a minute, please. Just a minute.
Right, help me out here.
Yeah, I'll be with you in a minute. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Richard Pryor, recruited in 1995, on Tuesday he became the first recipient of the Kennedy Center's Mark Twain Prize for Humor. This is Fresh Air. We created our Friday archive show to give us an excuse to replay interviews that we love, like the ones we heard on today's comedy edition. We have some extraordinary people represented in our archive, and you put them there. Your support is what has enabled us to chronicle American culture through our ongoing series of interviews. Thank you for your support. If you haven't made a pledge yet, please do it now. Thank you. Happiness is the new film by Todd Solondz, the director of Welcome to the Dollhouse. Although Happiness won the Critics' Prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival, it was later dropped by its original distributor because of its subject matter. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
When you call a movie Happiness nowadays, everybody knows you're kidding. The joke is pitch black in Todd Solondz's painfully funny new comedy, in which everyone is obsessed with the pursuit of happiness, and no one is any happier for it. Sort of a New Jersey version of an Altman movie, it interweaves the stories of several characters, centering on three grown-up sisters. Good-hearted Joy, played by Jane Addams, is a hapless folk singer who can't hold a tune, a man, or a decent job. Her icy sister Helen, amusingly played by Laura Flynn Boyle, is a famous writer who complains of being trapped in a state of irony. She's looking for a kinky brute of a lover. The most conventional is Trish. That's Cynthia Stevenson, a smug suburban mom who has no clue that her therapist husband, Bill Maplewood, bravely played by Dylan Baker, dreams of little boys and mass murder. They all inhabit a world that's like a situation comedy gone psychotic, in which seemingly chipper conversations take on dark undertones, as when Bill comes home after a day at work.
Hey.
Hi, how's work?
Oh, sorry. Hey, Billy. What's going on?
Nothing. He's depressed.
Well, is anything the matter?
I don't want to talk about it.
Ignore him. He's just doing it for attention. He thinks he'll be impressed, as if. So anyway, Joy came by today.
Huh. How's she doing?
Oh, God, I don't know. And frankly, I'm concerned. I mean, she's not like me. You know, she doesn't have it all. She pretends to be happy, but I can see right through her. She's miserable.
Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, to be frank, I think she's lazy. But she's not a go-getter like me or Helen. And she's so picky. I gave Damien Ross her phone number, for what it's worth. And Joy sounded interested, naturally, but I don't know. I'm afraid to have to say it, but truly, it's what I believe. She'll always be alone.
We're all alone.
Oh, Bill.
Happiness marks a quantum leap beyond Solondz's fluky breakthrough hit, Welcome to the Dollhouse, which I, like many critics, overpraised at the time. I frankly thought he might never make anything good again, but this new movie is wittier and more expansive, weaving a tapestry of suburban Americana with its beaming naivete and subterranean perversity. Its characters are all questing for something, love, sex, inner peace, but their search simply creates an endless daisy chain of thwarted desire. While the glamorous Helen craves a man who will treat her roughly in bed, the onanistic nerd down the hall, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, dreams of doing just that. In turn, he's pursued by his desperate, obese neighbor, Christina. In one way or another, all the characters get a taste of joy, only to have it quickly washed away by regret, loneliness, mortification, or the shadow of death. Happiness isn't impossible, but it's as fleeting as breath condensed on a mirror. The movie's vision of life is so black, it almost makes you feel sorry for New Jersey. What keeps it from becoming oppressive is Solanz's flair for the comedy of humiliation, that plunging moment when exaltation gives way to disaster. Happiness is filled with wickedly funny bits, like Joy's one-night stand with a shifty Russian taxi driver. Or in a scene more outrageous than anything in the new Lolita, Bill Maplewood drugging his family in order to indulge his sick predilections. The movie's key metaphor is his son Billy's desire to have his first orgasm, just like his junior high buddies. He tries and tries. This is a movie filled with hopeful people. And his efforts cap the finale, a family gathering so hilariously gross, it will make you forget Ben Stiller's stuck zipper in There's Something About Mary. Over the last months, Happiness has grown notorious for being shocking and controversial. While it's not really that, it is profoundly creepy, especially in the extraordinary scene when Bill talks to his son Billy about his child molesting. The two sit together, framed like Ward and Beaver Cleaver, discussing one of the Beeves' goofy antics. But what they're talking about here would have made a 50s TV explode. And the disturbing thing is, this scene may leave you laughing. Although Happiness often rises to brilliance, the film is beautifully acted and impeccably structured, it's also a dead end. In depicting the soul-crushing horrors of suburban life, Solanz's own vision is so pinched and so flat that it becomes a symptom of the very bleakness he wants to anatomize. Like the equally grim Your Friends and Neighbors, this is a movie that leaves you feeling that there's no hope. While this is a legitimate theme for an artist, it's hard not to think that Happiness is ultimately the work of a very talented but very unhappy filmmaker exacting his revenge on the world. Solanz doesn't just find the worm in the apple. He puts it there.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today was Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.